There we go. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Today we have Mr. John. He is a big famous member of the for the Boyos. They love him immensely. And I thought I'd bring him on and talk to him about the most controversial stuff possible, which is the end of the world, which seems to be the what is the thematic at the moment. And I actually really, really look forward to this because it's almost like a therapy for a Nietzschean in some sense, because I've obviously got extreme anxieties about what's going on in the world at the moment. I'm looking around me, seeing everything crumble down, and it looks like there is some type of ending feeling or end of something happening. And I think the premise I set up in our previous conversation was, I don't know which side I'm supposed to let place my bets upon. Like, is it going to turn into this thing where there'll be a collapse of the Christian worldview and it will be left behind like the way Roman paganism was, and we'll have to step into some type of new world, and you know, Nietzsche's the prophet of the new world or something like this, which is obviously like quite an intense thing to believe? Or is this the final test of Christianity, which is going to burst into the revelation and be like, all right, here's a rebirth, a new sort of era where we actually see it for what it is, updated for the modern world? So I guess at that I will if John, if you have anything you would like to say, or if you want to do any introduction. I don't think you need an introduction around here, by the way.
Well, thanks. No, I appreciate it. I'm happy that we could have like this conversation where we're gonna try to dive in as much as possible and see how it goes, see how it comes out.
Excellent. Excellent. Good stuff. Well, I'm a big fan. Like, there's actually a lot of things I'd like to talk to you about symbolism and the way, like, you've, as I've said before, you've theorized and displayed to me the way that symbols speak. It's like a language, you know, it's like a use of words using symbols and whatnot. And actually, a lot of people who are on my channel are there because of Jung, of course, and he would be very much that style of thinker. He would very much like take that very seriously and talk about the language of dreams and the language of myths and the language of symbols. And I'm not sure where you sit on Jung or whatnot, but it's just that general sort of category, if you will. And something I brought up the last time that I found absolutely fascinating was when Christ showed up in the world, there was this litany of symbolic ironies. Like, this is probably the best thing about it, because I think all this religion stuff is very heavy. You're like talking about God, you're like, it's all very serious, the end of the world, Jesus, morality, there's all very, very serious stuff. But when you actually, if you could zoom out and look at the kind of splatter of history as it went through, like what happened in Rome with Jesus was, it's almost hilarious. It's like a joke of some sort, you know, it's like a trick being played on people. As I've said, I was saying to you last time that you know, the cross is the ultimate symbol of Roman power. You stick the cross and you stick up your enemies on the cross, and it's like, we've defeated you, we've completely dominated you. And then the irony of them ending up worshiping a guy on a fucking cross of all things, like, it's just mind-blowing what's going on there. And I think the big thing that's irking me is it seems like that's maybe the opening of that irony is leading to this big, you know, 2000 year historical process. And it feels now, and you know, how much can we trust my feelings, that there's a kind of closing or a new irony showing up, you know, the idea of this is kind of crude, and I'm not trying to push it too hard, but the idea that it was, you know, the materialistic as down to earth process of science that in some sense saved the world, if you will, as opposed to the salvation into heaven and stuff like this. And the idea that we're going to create God by creating the artificial intelligence and stuff like this, instead of actually God coming down and saving us, like, we're going to make him. It's a very, very ironic set of things. It's almost like they're playing on the Christian myth itself. And this has always kind of set my mind ablaze. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. And where your head is at.
I think so. But I mean, there are many thoughts to have. First of all, it's important to understand that one of the parts, like, if you can understand kind of the story of Christ, like you said, almost like it's like it opens up a space. It opened up a space for certain things to happen. Like, it's the beginning of a story, or it's the setup of a pattern of a story, which the seeds, and then the fruits kind of come in the 2000 years that we've experienced. And one of the aspects that is there, a part of the Christian story, is the story of Antichrist. So in the story of Christianity, there's the theorized the idea that part of the story is also its opposite. Or that there's a part of the Christian story which is also its own betrayal, and it's there in the story of Christ himself. We always have to remember that Christ chose Judas as one of his disciples, knowing, because it's even shown in the story that he knows, right? Christ knows that Judas is going to betray him. You see that at the Last Supper, where Christ basically says, "Okay, now's the time. It's like Christ basically gives permission to Antichrist. He's like saying, okay, now's the time to do your thing. Now go out and betray me. But what's important is to understand that this seems to be part of something like the non-duality of the Christian story, which is that Christianity set up a space in which there's a proposition which contains also its anti-proposition and is leading towards a final resolution, right? Where all of this, I mean, I don't want to talk in Hegelian terms, that's not my point, but rather that it's kind of like the fullness of the story. And it's also part of the idea of Christ going into his own death and going into his own mockery and going into all of these types of things, which are part of his story. But in that mockery, the importance of the irony is to show that there's something else going on in the mockery. And that's the kingship, which is appearing kind of secretly in a weird upside down way, where as Christ is being mocked, he's being mocked as king. As he's being put on the cross, they have put a sign above his head saying that he's king. And so there's a way in which it's going to the end of the story, right? Going all the way into death, but transforming that death into something else, into glory, basically. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you could say that if you can understand that that's part of the Christian story, right? In the small story where it's Christ being betrayed, going into death and manifesting glory in his death. And then the giant story, which is that Christianity seems to have in its own process something like Antichrist, and that this will lead to, I mean, now we're not talking about historical things anymore. We're talking about a pattern that hasn't completely resolved itself. So it's all imagistic for now, but it's like Antichrist comes and Christianity seems to be even seduced into Antichrist. And then Christ returns and basically solves the puzzle.
Yeah, see, this is what I don't like, because this is, you know, all right, we have Jesus coming in and setting the agenda, and then we have the Antichrist, and it's a bit of a trap. Like, I'm wondering, maybe I'm jumping to conclusions, but it's sort of like he's sort of saying, all right, well, what's going to happen is it's like a honeypot, you know, we're going to throw out there and we're going to let everybody go, a bit kind of pagan, a bit techno Satan, you know, we'll let them go on and do that. And then they'll all reveal themselves, they'll all pop up and be like, Nietzsche, the prophet, Nietzsche the best, and all this. They'll all go for that. And then Christ will show up again and be like, you fucking retards. Like, I told you. You idiots. I literally wrote it in the book like for 2,000 years.
You should have known.
You should have known. Like, it was literally right there, right at the end, and you kind of got it. And I'm like, oh man, I don't know. And this is what I mean. Like, I will get into the Nietzschean position a lot, because what I really want to do is steel man as firmly as I can how I see Nietzsche. Because it's a very compelling position, you know, and there's a lot of very, very harsh challenges. But I guess this is the worry, and this is a genuine worry, you know. Like, look at the world that's going on now. We're clearly, like, it's without doubt, we're evolving rapidly since the Industrial Revolution. Like, this has been quote unquote progress that is not comparable to previous eras of history, I don't think. And this is a thing where, you know, populations have exploded. First of all sorts of strange habits have come up because of this. Also, so many of our problems are consequential of this blisteringly fast change of the Industrial Revolution, the rise of mass media, mass democracy, mass interaction. These, I mean, the fact that I'm talking to a guy in Canada, like, you know, the Europeans didn't even know Canada exists for most of their history. And this type of stuff is huge deal. And it signals that there's something unique, you know. And I think this is what I see an awful lot in the progressives or the people of the modern day, where they are adapting to that. They're saying, like, industrial, you've probably heard from a certain group of people saying, oh, the fourth industrial revolution and stuff like this. And yeah, they're talking about the next step. Let's give them their fair due. Maybe they are standing up and seeing themselves as the responsible people who are putting together a new framework and system to deal with all these very, very crazy and elaborate modern problems. And would it be unwise to sort of say, well, look, they're going in that, they're dealing with these obvious problems that we have, and they're doing this stuff, and if we're going to start to demonize that needlessly, we're going to be left behind as they blister off into the new era or something like this. And maybe even there might be some conflict because of this. I don't know if you have any thoughts, but I'll get into that more and more as I go on. But it's just
So there are a few things that I want to say, is that one of the important parts of understanding the story of Christ first of all, in terms of this thing, is I always say something like Christ fills up the world. Like that sounds like, it just sounds like a, just a religious posturing, but it's the notion that you're going to, everything gets old and everything dies, right? You're going to get old. You're going to die. You're going to get weak. You're going to be impotent. All of these things are going to happen to you, right? Even if you take the little blue pill, you will become impotent. It's in your future. Just deal with it, right? And so the idea is, in what you see in the story of Christ, in the small version of his story, and in the personal version of the story, and then in the cosmic version of the story, is showing the manner in which all of this comes together, you could say. How there's a possibility of filling up everything with something like glory, or with something like meaning. Meaning is easier to for people to swallow, let's say. And so fill all of this up with meaning. So there's a way in which you can, this is something you've heard before, right? Die before you die, right? If you die before you die, then you won't be a slave to death. That is, that if you become chaste before you become impotent, then when you become impotent, it won't matter. But if you idolize, for example, sexual desire, then when you become impotent, you're going to just be a loser. That's all you're going to be. You're going to be that old buffalo that is waiting to be killed by the lions, right? Or the old lion that's just waiting to be killed by the lions. But what something like what the story of Christianity sets up is a way to kind of move into death successfully, you could say, without it just being scandal, without it just being something that eats you up. So that's on the personal scale. Now on the, like on the large scale, the idea that this is what's going on now, like it's completely new, I think is just not true. You know, I think that this story has happened before. This story has been told before. It's there in scripture. It's there in the tradition. Even the technology part, even the civilization part, all of this, even the kind of transhuman aspect, it's all there in scripture and in the tradition, especially the Book of Enoch, where we see this kind of more, let's say, fleshed out in terms of a story. But once you kind of understand it, look, the story of Atlantis, for example, like there are stories that are not Christian, but that have a similar frame as to what's happening to us today. And so I think that, how can I say this? The very idea of basing the future on technology is itself, it's an impossibility. It can't work. It's not going to bring us to a new age. Mm-hmm. It's not possible, right? The because what happens is people sacrifice wisdom for technical knowledge. And they do. We all see that they do. It's like everybody has a phone and everybody knows that that phone is killing them. Mm-hmm. But we still have our stupid phones. I have a phone. I use my phone, but I know my phone is killing me. And so we everybody knows that you trade wisdom for power in the world, for power in the world. And especially, let's say, power that's added, like layers, right? These layers that we add to ourselves. And so the transhumans, they're completely deluding themselves, right? It's the Tower of Babel story once again. And it doesn't work. Even in terms of system, it doesn't work. If you take even this idea, like even now what we're seeing with this kind of these COVID passports and these desire to kind of just account for everything, or to exclude, the idea to exclude disease, for example, from society. It's like these things they're not possible. You know, you can't have a coherent system which is complete at the same time. It's just an impossibility. And so what happens is these things lead to breakdown. They lead to what happened in the communist era, you know, this desire to have state-controlled everything and centralized, universal everything, and then people starve to death. Mm-hmm. And this is what's coming. The same thing is coming if they keep going. They keep pushing in this direction. We're going to have as big or much bigger crisis than what we had in the early 20th century.
And so this, I think, is where the rubber begins to hit the road, because this is a clear, obvious description of the danger. I guess it's very good to look to the communist revolution as something quite shocking in that it was the ascension of a state. They literally had, like, again with that irony thing, you know, they had the League of Militant Atheists, as I literally think what it was, and they were cascading, like, just getting rid of all the previous Christian iconography and the church structures and the intellectuals and all this type of stuff, and they're creating a new man and they're creating a new world. And there's a couple of different things I want to say about this. First of all, is that the premise that they were running that up, like, all right, how can I put this without sounding ridiculous? They, like, Marx wasn't wrong when he was saying that there's things are going to massively change. Like, he's basically sort of saying we have to be reactionaries to technology, and we have to, like, it's like he was looking at history. This is his story, and he sort of said, all right, obviously Hegel talked to him about this, and he looks at history and he predicts that the future is going to unfold a certain way, and I'm going to try guess what that endpoint is, which is the communist utopia when the bourgeoisie are overthrown, and I'm going to postulate, like, set out a premise, set out an idea about how that's going to happen, and here's an action plan, and just do it. You know, take away private property. That's my first principle. You're like, all right, Carol, take it easy there. But that's what he goes for, and people execute upon that, and they take that and they try to deal with the problem. And what's interesting, I always try to look at this as clear as I can. He was just proposing a plan, and he was just saying, well, do this. Now, it wasn't a good plan. But if you talk to any, like, military general, professional athlete, artist, anything, it's like, you don't need a businessman. You don't need a perfect plan. You just need a plan. A plan is probably more forward than a bad plan, or no plan, if you know what I mean. And yeah. this is constantly something that is levied at the Christians. You could say the conservatives, whatever you want. And I think it relates to my other point, is that it's like, I do understand it's a very rich and deep religion that can bring you huge amounts of meaning, but it sometimes feels like there's no assertive plan. There's nothing, there's no way to take action with. It actually feels disempowering in some way. And I'll just qualify this with the last thing I want to say. This then leads to the other danger. You could even say, this is the sort of Nietzschean reactionary perspective, isn't that maybe Nietzsche, unlike Marx, or maybe as a progressive and extreme as Marx, he would propose a plan. He would propose a way forward that wouldn't be the same as Marxism, like, would be different than the progressivism and what we might call the delusion of the preachers of equality that's so prominent nowadays. And he would suggest something that's far more electric and maybe inspiring and far more captivating to specifically, I guess you could say, young men and stuff like this. But he would speak in that type of way. And it's a very, very, very alluring idea of, like, he is dismissive, of course, but he's saying, hey, we have a plan, we have a way forward, we have something we can do. I'm sure you've heard that before, but I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, I get it. I think that, well, there are a few things to say about that. One is, there's an aspect in which there's a kairos, or there's an aspect in which that the world lays itself out in a certain way, and the idea that you can completely change the way the world lays itself out, I think, is a little bit of a delusion, right? And so let's say you imagine a man getting old and getting older and older, and at some point it's like you can have all the plans you want, the rot is there, like, it's gonna fall apart. And so, you know, I know I discourage people when I talk this way, but I think that at this point right now, I don't know if there's a solution. I don't know if there's a solution to the situation that can happen now. Like, things have to play themselves out. And so I think that the only way to, this is, it's like, I'm good, people are gonna think I'm going Jordan Peterson, but I'm not going Jordan Peterson as much as understanding the way that he expresses things is a lesser version of the way that the saints talk about the world, which is that the only plan you can have really in this situation is to become a saint, is that you need to become more than you are. And maybe that is, in a way, a Nietzschean position, maybe just not viewed in the same direction. Like, you have to transform yourself to be a catalyst for at least an arc, right? At least something to kind of hold something together as everything else collapses, you know, and as a seed for the new beginning. So I think that that's really at this point, I'm not super engaged politically. I've been a little more vocal now with how crazy COVID is, because it's just so, it's like the authoritarianism is coming at 100 miles an hour. And so I'm like, okay, this is, you know, I drive me crazy to see that people don't see it. But I don't think that even there's something we can do about it. Like, what are you going to do about it? It's happening. It's like the steamroller slowly moving over you. And it seems like the best way is to be a saint in the world as much as possible, to be something which will bind us together as much as we can, and to be able to move into this death, which is coming, or this crisis, which is going to get worse, you know, and not completely collapse in front of it, and not be a coward. Mm-hmm. To not be, you know, because there are things coming that will make us cowards, that will force us to compromise step by step to a point where people will just become shells. We're already, a lot of us are on the road there, but mm-hmm. it's like we need to have something to hold us together so we don't become that.
I think that's, like, you know, that's big boy talk. Like, that's the manly stuff right there, because there's two sides of what you're saying. I want to bring up, and one of them is, of course, like the incredible importance of what you're saying. Like, no matter what way it goes, say, for example, you were in communist Russia and you were perhaps lamenting that there wasn't this massive Nietzschean plan getting formed among the Romanovs aristocracy to prepare for this revolution and stuff like this, and you're getting angsty with them. But ultimately, when the rubber hits the road, you know, you live in a time of peace, the Romanovs can serve this, and there's something coming down the line that's going to be horrific. It's going to be absolutely terrible. And you may think that you're prepared, you may think that you're ready, you may think that your head's in order, the possibility for you breaking is unbelievable, and it's just frightening what can happen to a person when real pressure is put on them. You know this in stuff like martial arts, like everybody goes around and thinks that they can fight, but you put them in a gym with someone who can't fight and you just see them mentally break so quickly, because the pressure, pain, intensity, fear, when fear kicks in, you turn into Gollum. Like, it's not even so much like the Christian story of you'll become Satan, you know, and you'll grow horns and beat everyone up, although that will happen to some people. But actually, most people will just turn into like the decrepit, hiding wretch of fear that like lumps themselves down onto the floor or something like that. Whereas the great, great, great power of the Christian story that I see so much, that I think is really important and is a very profound thing to meditate on, is the idea of walking to your death with dignity and saying, like, you know, you can take my life, but you can't take my soul. And ain't nothing more powerful than that. Like, that's big boy stuff. And I absolutely agree.
But for now, there's a situation. Like, have you seen, I watched it recently because everybody told me to watch it. There's a movie called A Hidden Life by Terrence Malick. Have you seen this movie?
Haven't
seen
it?
Yeah, it's worth watching, because it's someone in Hitler's, he's in Austria during the time that Hitler's rising to power. And he decides that he can't swear allegiance to Hitler, right? That's what it's about. It could have been about anything else, but it doesn't matter. He decides that he can't, as a Christian, do that. And then it plays out all the consequences in his life. And I think that people don't realize that. You see it now, like, people don't realize that people will use Christianity even to make you into that Gollum, right? They'll use, you see that now, like, you know, like, I hate to talk about this on YouTube, but let's say that I decided not to go through with the procedure. And I'm not even scared of the stupid procedure, to be honest. Like, it doesn't bother me that much. What bothers me is to watch the authoritarian state kind of march towards me. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to resist this just because I know that what's coming is worse. And if I can't resist this, I'm going to get steamrolled after this, because what's coming is much worse. And so I think that, and people are using compassion. Like, if you're compassionate, you would give in to the state mandate. And if you were compassionate, you know, you would. And people are saying it's a sin not to get the procedure, not to go through as Christians. Like, I've seen people say things like, if you don't, you should go to confession for it. And I'm like, man, this is some intense stuff. And so you can feel it's nothing, right? It's like, I'm still fine. I'm here. I'm doing my thing. I'm going to the store. But you can see how just this little seed, how it can grow. And you can feel your weakness inside you, right? It's worth to analyze that and to realize how much. Yeah. And so when the pressure comes, man, I think most of us are going to break, but we need to need to at least be aware that it's coming, because it's coming soon.
And I think to refer back to what you were sort of bringing up, because it was sort of a question about like, all right, who's what plan are we going to do? Like, oh, the Marx is after writing his exciting book and everyone's reading it, and you're like, wait a second, this is not going to end well. Wait a second, I have private property. What's going on here? And so you're sort of saying to yourself, you got to get mentally prepared and whatnot. You're trying to prepare a plan. You're trying to put yourself together, as Jordan Peterson might say. And I think that's really important and something like I would like to stress, you know, let's pause a little bit and stress this. But the sort of premise that I see you suggesting is one of fatalism, if you will, like it's going to happen. And even to the point where it might even be, it's almost like actually sort of Nietzschean, it's a doctrine of entropy, like as in the society is scaled too big. Babylon is at her peak. She is not in a good place. And it's quite obvious. You look around, this is not sustainable. This is not going to keep running. Too many people having too many crazy parties. You know, there's too many pagan idol worship going on. Babylon, God is up there and he's literally like with a thunderstorm saying, I wrote it in the book, guys. Don't make me do it again. I will get them. I'll get the Assyrians. Like, I'll make it happen. And it's coming. And there's a sort of submission to the inevitable, if you will, which is actually like, it's like Hamlet at the end of Hamlet, the readiness is all, it's going to happen. Destiny is here. It's there's nothing we can do about it. Like it's just embrace it, prepare yourself, get ready for the fight, get ready for the war. And there's definitely martial valor in that. There's definitely something powerful in that. But again, and this is like a very hefty accusation from Nietzsche, I would see him 150 years ago saying that the danger of Christianity is that it's fundamentally nihilistic, and in some sense that's what we mean. Like it's unable to postulate an assertive plan of action. And let's put it this way, it's reactionary and defensive to what's happening in the modern world, and always going to leave you in a position of being incapable of asserting something forward, of saying to yourself, I'm going to take the power into my own hands and push forward. I'm going to do something about this. Like in some sense, these big bad people who are orchestrating all this, and they might genuinely have negative intent, I just don't see why we should be so trusting. And at the same time, part of it is that they're just seizing the day, you know, like there's no one else doing it and they're just in that position, and they say, well, we've got to make society work some way, so we've got to, like, we're preparing for massive super databases of people, and then, well, like obviously we're going to need connection with the biological as well, and so this is their way of going into it. And it looks like the Antichrist, I mean, maybe it is, maybe they're unconsciously fulfilling something like this, but they're executing on a will to power, if you will. And as far as I would see, Nietzsche would say is that it's like this is sort of communism has never been tried, but Nietzscheism has never been tried. You know what I mean? Have you ever sort of sat down and say, how about we actually have a go at this? How about we actually, instead of reacting, instead of playing defensive, instead of worrying, instead of submitting to entropy, and we can talk about that in a minute, and we could say, well, how do you study the past and postulate out something we could do going forward?
All right. Well, I hate, like, I really hate going into politics too much, but like, if you look at the world right now, and you look at the places that don't seem to be giving into this entropy and do seem to have an actual real plan to kind of deal with this, you know, both on a narrative level and on a social level, what's the difference between these places? And the difference is going to be that they're Christian. That's the difference. Like,
yeah, all right,
that's just enough. The truth, man. It's like, if you want to look at the places that are kind of gathering themselves together and saying, okay, no, we don't want this. Like, this is what we want. And they're kind of pushing and pulling and moving things in another direction. They're doing it under the guise of Christianity. And it's because I think it's also because people struggle to understand. We talked about this a little bit before. People struggle to understand, for example, that Christ, we see Christ on the cross and we think that that's the only thing, but we always have to remember that Christ on the cross has a title which declares him king, and that leads to an image of Christ, which is also the Pantocrator, right? Christ as the divine logos in the vault of the church, who is the source of reality, who is the active namer of all that exists and is the judge of the world. And so we always have to remember that as Christ fills together, and we can't just point to the image of the cross and say, well, it's just about a guy getting killed on the cross, but it's not, because, and it's a lie to say that it is, because it's not, right? It is all of this together. And but there is a reality in which the idea of the willingness to die, how can I say this, willfully, that is actually the source of strength. It's like a mystery, but that is really, you could say, the thing that Christ kind of reveals is that once you're willing to die and you're not afraid of death anymore, then all of a sudden, everything is possible. And so that will manifest itself in many ways. Some people will become monks and ascetics and will live in that kind of perpetual exercise of death. But then lower than that, then you, out of that, will actually come out something like empire or an emperor or a king. And so it's hard for people to see it, but it's like, if you look at it historically, that's actually what happened. And as we slowly moved away from Christianity, that's when this breakdown started to happen. And I think it's part of the story. I think that it's actually part of the Christian story, in the sense that I think, because all structures have this entropy in them. So as you kind of, but I think that the Christian story, or Christ, seemed to set up a story that is going to end in a manner that's part of the story and will lead to a resurrection, right? I mean, I don't know exactly what that looks like, but that's the point, is that to live a certain way, that you die, you're willing to die, will lead towards new life.
That's incredibly powerful. And I, like, again, as much as I talk about the magic German incel, like, I don't want to discourage that. Like, it's the foundation towards, in fact, it's something we could talk about, is the foundation of the idea of virtue is ultimately, like, are you willing to step into the chaos and do what needs to be done? Are you willing to face reality? The ultimate reality, the ultimate chaos, is of course the fact that you're going to die. And, you know, this is existentialism 101. There's two,
but like, in terms of Nietzsche, like, maybe in terms of Nietzsche, I think that the place where he could maybe went off is that the notion of self-willing is a notion that is flawed. It's flawed in itself, because there's something before you, and there's something above you, and there's something of you that you don't know. Right, the, what is it, like 98% of your psychological processes are unknown to you. And so the idea that you could, out of that, self-will yourself, it's a problem. Because that's why I think that that's one of the things that might explain kind of Nietzsche's breakdown. I mean, I hate to kind of, you know, hit a person who's suffering, but it's like the surprise of the thing you didn't account for, right? It's like the thing that you're like, I'm going to be this, I'm going to be that, I'm going to be strong, I'm going to be self-willing, I'm going to overcome my weakness, you know, I'm going not to be sentimental, and then all of a sudden, like, you break down because some guy's beating a horse. It's like the ultimate kind of social justice Christian compassion that appeared in him, right? It's like all of a sudden he's willing to hug a tree, you know, to stop it from being cut down. And it's like swipe, right? It's like the swipe that comes because you didn't expect it. You didn't think that was in you.
Yes. In fact, if you look at many of his last writings, like, he, for example, began to describe himself as the crucified. So he would start to say that I am Dionysus to some of his friends, and I am the crucified. So Dionysus was his vision of a new instinct of God, which in fact is somewhat of an answer to something you're suggesting. And it's clear that this man was struggling with Christ, like, without doubt, like, he was splitting in half, essentially. And there's a lot of different ways you can look at this. One of them, for example, is that Jung and the Red Book was a symbol of maybe someone struggling with the same problem, the confrontation with the Antichrist. 40, 50 years after Nietzsche. And so maybe Jung could handle it better because everybody around him at this point was talking about this. Whereas Nietzsche basically like stepped out into the river as the tsunami was coming. It was the first time maybe most people kind of confronted this, and he wasn't able for it. And his, you know, his dad was a Protestant minister. Like maybe his heart wasn't in it or something like that. And he snapped. And he certainly like, it kind of ruins the whole vibe of the doctrine. It's like be an Ubermensch and you're like, dude, you hugged a horse and you ended up naked being taken care of by your sister. Like, come on.
But he might have been a prophet, like he might have been a prophetic figure in the sense that he might have had that sensibility. Some people have sensitivity towards the pattern, like they're able to see it coming from far away. And I think that maybe that he definitely had that, you know, he just like Marx probably had something similar too, this capacity to kind of to see it coming from afar. But then what? I mean, I have a lot of compassion for Nietzsche too, because the Christianity that he was dealing with was so lame that it's like, what are you gonna do? Like it's just basically this moralism and this kind of praise of weakness, as you said, but praise of weakness there is a way in which you can, how can I say this? There is a way in which you can see that willful weakness or the capacity to embrace weakness, not pretending, right? Because some people are weak because they're cowards, and that's not the same as embracing weakness or seeing your weakness and not denying it, you could say something like that. But he was facing a moralistic, you know, very, I don't know, so where was he going to look? I don't know, it's not easy for him to, he didn't have, where was he going to find something else besides what was there?
And I think the answer to this, or his answer, if you will, and I do find this captivating. Again, it frames an awful lot of what we're talking about, because I don't think he was looking to himself as becoming the Ubermensch. He actually, like, in fairness to him, he saw incredible logical problems and moral problems. He genuinely was, and I'd love to talk about morality in this, but he saw himself as taking incomprehensible responsibility. Like he would make statements like, and you know, this could be arrogance as well, but he would make statements like, we're not going to make it if we don't reevaluate our values. We're not going to make it. We're all going to fail. There'll be no Bitcoin. There'll be no Ethereum. It won't happen. Like, we're not going to make it. We're all going to lose. And we have to do this job. Someone has to stand up, and no one's even thinking about this yet. Now I'm by myself stuck in the mountains. Like, no one's even close to where I'm at. And Zarathustra, like Jung even said this about him, and this from Jung's sort of psychoanalysis thing, like Nietzsche was like, it was like he was trapped by himself in his own head in the 19th century, thinking about this crazy possibility of like the entirety of Europeans dominating the world, and that was all going to fall if they weren't careful. And then he literally had a schizophrenic break and met Zarathustra, which was the consolidation of his, you know, higher self, or whatever you want to call it, maybe the vision of God presenting itself, the prophet constructing a new way for him to go forward, actually helping him. And then Nietzsche is sort of possessed with this job where he has to try bring it forward, but he knew he couldn't do it himself. He was a very frail man. He understood it. Like he was broken down in many ways, and he didn't see himself as the Ubermensch. His direct statements were stuff like, I'm not going to be the Ubermensch, you're not going to be the Ubermensch, none of us are. We're building a world to possibly have an Ubermensch in the future. We're preparing now for a new birth, for a new life. And in fact, much of it is a philosophy of very, very affirmative responsibility. Like, he does actually speak in these terms, and he speaks in a way that he's like, this is what I mean by this assertiveness. Like, you would read through some of his statements, and one of them would be directly talking to the sort of conservative, you could even say Christian types that are stuck appealing towards a future. And he would sort of say, it's not coming. And like, I like, come on, and we'll go this direction, and we'll try this out, and we'll assert forward, and we'll like lift up responsibility.
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, I think that there's some part of that which is okay. I think the difficulty is in the self-willing. It's in the idea of seeing yourself as the top of the pattern, and not. I mean, maybe he was trying to. How can I say this? Maybe he was trying to kind of find new gods or find some god that he could worship, let's say, or that he could submit himself to. But I don't know if that's really what he was doing, because he was stuck in, I mean, he was a materialist ultimately, seems, or like a physicalist, you could say.
It's a strange character. I guess the thing that I'm noticing, because for example, when you say self-willing, the thing that I see in him is that he was actually just like a very like classically good philosopher. He was trying to reason from first principles. What was the cause of success? I'm sure you've heard this before somewhat, but basically like, did Christianity succeed because it was Christianity, or was it succeeding because the people who created the West were the barbarians who were full of instinctive energy, fresh out of the jungles of Rome, of Northern Europe.
Yeah.
Actually, like the story of Christianity is essentially tied to the story of the fall of Rome, and the rise of the West is not the triumph of all of the Christian world. It's the triumph of basically the Goths, the Germans, the people who monopolized the European civilization after Rome fell. They swooped in, and these were people who lived in, you know, they were halfway between barbarism and civilization. They were blended between the two of them. So they had instinctive power, but technical sophistication blended together very, very well. And then they brought Christianity with them, and that energy inside of them, he would consider that energy, it could have been even spiritual to him. I don't really know, but it's the first cause. It's the first principle. It's the first principle of the universe as far as he's concerned. And then the story as he would present is that it's not necessarily like an ego self choosing. Like if you're a decrepit golem and you say, I'm the master of you, like I don't think he's saying that at all. I think he's sort of saying, if you look at why people succeed, they usually have an abundance of this creative energy inside of them. And why a people in general would have this is because of the same sort of principles and reasons. And I guess this is a very subversive thing to say, but it's essentially robbing Christianity, like it's pulling it out of the hands and saying, no, it's not the words, it's not the ideology, that's just a dress for something deeper. And the reason why the entire modern society has fallen apart, the reason why all these terrible things are happening, the reason why people's emotional defenses are just cascading into oblivion is because they've lost the energy, they've lost the animus, they've become over-civilized. And in fact, Christianity ain't going to fix that, and atheism isn't going to fix that, and no religion is, because they're all the incorrect premise, the incorrect cause. Marx won't work either. And in fact, all you need is the right cause.
All right, so let me just reframe what you said. Like,
sure.
Let me reframe the story and see what you think, okay? Because I think that in framing it that way, there's a certain dishonesty with how it actually happened, which is that I totally agree with this idea of the power or the strength coming down from the north. I think that it's not only true of Western Europe, but it's also true of Eastern Europe, because you know the Bulgars and the Russians. You know, the aristocracy of Russia were Scandinavians too, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. And so they were coming down, and the Byzantine Empire was held in the end. The strength of the Byzantine Empire was held by the Varangians. The Varangians were the guard of the emperor, and they were all Scandinavians. They were sent by different kings, you know, like the different kings in the Scandinavian world, down through the Ukraine, you know, through the Prince of Kiev, who was Scandinavian, and then into the Byzantine Empire. But so the idea is, so think about it this way, like think about the Mongols, right? The Mongols are also this strength from the north, right? They are this like massive bundle of disembodied energy, you would call it. They, you know, they go in every direction, but the Mongols come down and the Huns come down, and they just destroy. That's all they do. They just rape, they pillage, they burn, they raise to the ground. You know, the Mongols even like took pride in it. They said, we're gonna turn Baghdad into a grazing place for our horses, right? That's what they were proud of, that they leveled Baghdad to the ground, that there was nothing left of it, no trace of it, you know. And so that's that energy that comes in now. So the northern people come in, that's what they do, right? The Scandinavians come down, they rape, they pillage, they steal, they burn, they destroy. And it's only when they convert to Christianity that they do the things you say that they do. It's as if, so understand it this way, like understand it like energy and sacrifice, right? So you it's called chastity. It's called control. It's called, so you actually sacrifice some aspect of your energy and you focus it towards a point. And that's how you're able to make civilization. But doing that looks like worship. It looks like, you know, you all focus together. So all these pagans come down, they convert to Christianity, and then they focus their energy. And they have something like liturgy, they have a hierarchy of in the church, they have hierarchies in society, and then they're able to do what they do. And so the idea that Charlemagne wasn't like a Christian king for all his faults is hogwash. It's just not true. The idea that the tsars of Russia were not Christian is just bullshit. Like, they really were. They were off. Like, they had all these things wrong about them, but they really were. And the image of the knight is the ultimate image of this, right? The image of the knight is the image of that energy, which is focused into like service towards your king, service towards God, you know, so that now it is productive and not just wild energy, which is let loose and which is basically just destruction. And so I think that that's the difference, like the difference between the Picts, who are just these crazy barbarians, naked, blue painted, that came down and just, you know, and
that's my neck of the woods. Take it easy there.
All right. So the difference between that and, you know, the kings of the Dukes of Normandy and the kings of Sicily and the tsars of Russia is a very different thing. And it happens through worship. Like, it happens through focus, attention to something above you, which binds you together and makes you able to act in one direction. And if tribe did it a little bit, tribe does it a little bit, but it does it in a very limited way, right? Tribe doesn't reach empire because there's no way to transcend your affiliation. But that's what religion does. It makes you transcend affiliation towards something beyond you.
And this is an excellent point, and I like don't disagree on any level at all. Like, this is absolutely true. Like, there's the Goths were Christian actually when they conquered Europe. Like, they
were Christian. Yeah, when they conquered Rome, they're already Christian.
Yeah. Yeah, Alaric coming in being like, for Christ, get out of here, yeah, Itai, you Italian, get out of here. Speaking of which, there'll be no more Gaelic, anti-Gaelic tropes on this, talking about us in our blue paint. What's this all about? thought you'd appreciate it as an artist yourself.
I'm French, so I'm also of Gaulois descendants, probably. So don't worry about it. I've got my Gaelic too.
Okay, might be the chip on the shoulder then or something. He's uncomfortable. Sure, come back to your pagan ways, John. Give up this Christian stuff. Just paint yourself, run out there.
The Gaelic people are some of the first people to convert, by the way. Rome converted, they were already like, British Christianity didn't need Rome to be a flowering, amazing thing. It was just this powerful, yeah. They just lack the muscle, which they got when they joined with these northern people.
Yeah, I'm trying to LARP as a Nietzschean here. Don't be telling me that the Irish were Christians or something like this. It's very true. Actually, something that you'd see sometimes in circles up around here would be that the Galatians were in Turkey, were the Galatians in Spain, which were also Galilee. And some people would be like, Jesus was an Irishman. Like,
he was an Irishman.
You do that from time to time. You'd be like, you know what? I'll take it. Nietzsche or that. That's the only two choices I have. So
Jesus was Gaelic or Nietzsche.
Yeah, I'm probably going to hell either way. Let's put it this way. So, actually, to bring it back, it's something that you were saying. I think this is just a very, very fascinating point, and it's something that Nietzsche in himself actually described. The difference between masculine and feminine cultures, because you'd imagine like the category that. I consider it a bit of a straw man of Nietzsche is that he's like saying manly will to power and Vikings come down and defeat the under people and Christianity slave religion, because he wasn't so strict in saying that Christianity was off the wall bad. He would declare very, very straightforward and beyond good and evil that there's masculine religions, feminine. He considered the French a feminine religion. This is not to say that they're weak. They're profoundly militarily successful, but the way they sort of orientate themselves is he would sort of suggest them as like a sort of a culture cultural. It's like when you get a wife, you build her the house, the masculine behavior, and then she goes feng shui on the inside of the house and makes it look really nice. Like that's the sort of difference here. And he would look at the Romans and the Germans and the Jews and the Japanese and the Arabs and the Vikings. He'd look at them as like specifically masculine cultures, destroyers, actually, is precisely how you say it. He was always giving out about the Germans as being kind of blunt and uncultured for precisely these reasons. The Romans the same, you know, they're very assertive, they're very male, but they
it's all just the French. He just didn't like me. He doesn't like the French. But go ahead.
Well, he said the French, the Greeks, like he liked the French and the Greeks the most. Like he thought they were his favorite cultures. He saw the French and the Greek. He called them feminine cultures, but it was because of the way they approach things. Like they would receive in, the whatever it is and perfect it. They like out of France blossomed the highest culture, and Nietzsche ultimately valued that. That's sort of his principle and his goal. And this is a really good point. Like you have the Vikings and, you know, we like to romanticize them as cool, but ultimately they're probably just a load of lads who hopped in a boat and went around like just causing ruckuses among monasteries. It's not that cool. Like it's just, they're just rapscallions. You know, but what is cool is like, you know, maybe Charlemagne wielding like an incredibly large army or a crusade or something like that. That's a big war. Like that's guys fighting big boy stuff. And that's only possible within the context of civilization. And I think that's a really good point. And I do think that's very, very true. And in fact, the knight, a great symbol for that, the civilized barbarian, the man who has assertive will to power pointed towards something that is purposeful, like that is justified. Now, we could have the conversation about critiquing what we consider valuable under this reason, but it is about raising up the instincts beyond mere fallen urges and barbarism and violence and destruction. In fact, the masculine urge does need to in some sense be tamed and perfected by the feminine urge. But I think this is again where he flips this on his head a little bit, and he then goes on to accuse Christianity of only really being suitable for barbarians like that. Like it actually worked really well with the Goths and the Scandinavians, but this is a really interesting point to me.
And he ignores Constantinople as usual.
Well, he's the Western writers.
It's not his fault. He didn't probably even know about Constantinople. So I don't want to say that, but like Constantinople is always the wrench into all these ideas. Like Constantinople is just Roman Empire continuing for 1,000 years. And that's how they perceive themselves, and that's how they acted, and that's how they the idea that Rome fell is already just it's just bull. It retracted. It didn't fall. And the Byzantines remained powerful and sophisticated for a very long time, you know. So, anyways.
Yeah. Yes, and I don't disagree at all. And but I guess the thing I'm looking at is. He's like analyzing these pieces of history because I don't think he's necessarily trying to score points as much as we think. Like I don't, and I like, geez, there's so many things I don't understand about the history to say this was the cause, this wasn't the cause or something like that. I think what he's trying to do is zoom out and see the big picture. All right, what's the actual causes we should focus on to make a plan for the future? So for example, he would accuse Christianity of being the perfect thing maybe for a hyper masculine barbarian, but our problem is that we're hyper feminine in some sense. Our problem is we're over civilized. Our problem is that we're late stage Rome, and we actually need that barbarian energy to come back. Like how do you awaken this? And this is a really interesting question. Like if that's the issue, how does one evoke the will to power out of people? Is it even possible? Like once it's gone, maybe you don't get it back. It's not that straightforward or something like this. And this is really like many of his accusations towards Christianity stem from this. He would even say that it's such a powerful civilizing force that maybe has feminine qualities because that's what civilizing is. It can lead to castration if you're not careful. Like it's got like, you know, it will take a wolf and turn it into a pug if you leave it long enough and don't reassert and be like, wait a second, I don't want a pug. I want something close to a wolf, but like a dog, like a German Shepherd maybe, or a spaniel or something like this. I want something like that's good, that can bite. I want that type of energy in it. And this is in some sense his sort of accusation is that someone who is actively thinking about what type of person are we breeding, are we creating, are we shaping with these ideas is really important, because it maybe is nice to think that you can tame a barbarian with a really profound story of love and beauty and all this, but long term, what happens if you over civilize the barbarian and over socialize them and turn them into a golem, perhaps? Because you look at many of the Scandinavians now, and they're like, you know, a lot of guys are sort of right wing, like they're all, you know, they're super liberal, super welfare, all this type of stuff, and you're like, wait a second, they're the Vikings, like what's going on up here, this type of thing. And why might that be? It's a very interesting question.
Yeah, I agree that there is a move towards over civilization. It definitely comes, I think it comes more with the Enlightenment than with Christianity, and it comes more with the kind of desire for excessive technification and the worship of technology and the worship of making life easier. Like the idea that making life easier is the purpose of existence. I really don't see that as a Christian value, to be honest. Maybe on the fringes, like I said, as Christianity kind of falls apart, we have this idea. But even the idea, let's say, of removing suffering is not a Christian idea. Like the idea that people shouldn't suffer, that nobody should suffer, that nobody should have bad things happen to them, is not something that you find in the Christian. I mean, that's why, you know, the image of, you know how like asceticism started, right? Asceticism started because when the emperor converted to Christianity, it became so easy to be Christian that people said, okay, well then I'm going to go like live in the desert and like, you know, eat three leaves a day. And just because it's too easy to be Christian. And asceticism was seen as a way to, as a kind of warrior mentality where it was about, but now it was maybe more turn toward the inside, which is like to be able to kind of master yourself, you could say, you know, because now before let's say the challenge of being in front of the Roman legate and the Roman legate saying, are you a Christian? And now you're faced with whether or not you're going to be a coward. Like it's right there in front of you. It's like, am I a coward or I'm not a coward? Because the question is direct and I'm faced with myself in an existential way. That was gone. So it's like, well, what do we do to stay strong? Well, one of the ways was like, okay, we're going to go and face ourselves in the desert. So that's the way I see kind of the Christian ethos is this kind of self-challenging, it's not, we tend to see it as, how can I say this? We tend to see the idea that Christians have to eliminate their desires. And I think that there's a way in which maybe sometimes it's framed that way, but I think ultimately the idea is that desire has to be transformed, right? It has to be honed. It has to be turned towards something higher, you could say. And Eros is actually the driving force for the spiritual life. You know, I'm reading a great book right now by a man, Dr. Timothy Petitzas, who writes about, he has a whole, it's called The Ethics of Beauty. And he has this really powerful chapter on Eros and how present Eros is in the writings of the Church Fathers and how eroticism is the means to become sanctified. Like it's the mean to holiness is erotic, but it's like gathering that energy and kind of turning it towards self-transformation and turning it towards beauty and turning it towards things that are higher. But it's not, you're right, it's not exactly the warrior type of thing that you might expect. But downstream from that, the warriors is always is there. Like in a world of monks, you'll find knights.
It's absolutely true. And again, it's something that like it'd be cliche for me to walk in and be like, oh, Christianity, slave religion, all girls. Like that's absolutely not true. Like it's not true at all. They're absolutely packed full of some of the most Chad men who have ever lived. Like it is literally, you know, European history is decorated with them, medieval knights. It has a great track record for forming strong people. Like that's without doubt true.
But the question is, what do we do now? Like I think that's the biggest thing that seems to be like hurting you or just making you wonder, like, okay, what do I, like here I am in a world that is post-Christian or degenerate Christian and like all these social justice values which look like a parody of Christianity, like a weird disturbing parody of this kind of victim culture, all of this is there. Like I agree that there, so what do we do?
So this is actually the thing I wanted to talk about, because that is like, all right, well, what is the nature of the problem? And I think it comes down to a psychological problem in many levels of generalized demoralization is what I'd say, which you could actually take to mean many different things. And so one of them is, I think even if we're to center it on the Europeans, there's this horrible infectious shame. Like the Irish, even at this point, you know, hate themselves for being colonialists. At this point, you're kind of like, lads, you're not thinking this through at all. Like, what's going on here? There's this massive chip on the shoulder and lack of identity and the crushing of who you are and a disconnect from your history. And like most people are turning into that Gollum consumer that leaps into the future and says all the nice things and in some sense postures in a way that I could only describe as somewhat Christian and religious, but it's like, as you would say, a parody of that, a horrible one as well. Like, why don't we get the knights? Why don't we get that version of Christianity? No, we get the golems instead. It's quite annoying. And I do think the reason why Nietzsche is so compelling to me is that, well, all right, so two things, like the demoralization question, the answer is actually very firmly could be either, because Nietzsche talks about remoralizing people by saying that the primary cause has been the lack of this animated energy. And if you could create a culture that allowed that energy to flourish again, and this would happen in many different ways, like he is very much a neo-pagan. He would look back, you might appreciate this as someone who studies symbols, he would look at the statues in Greece as representations of a very healthy, strong, animated, energetic people representing themselves, like the way we look at beautiful pictures of, you know, models and stuff like this, representing themselves in their ideal state. And this is highly moralizing and highly exciting and highly aspiring. There's a guy called Ziz, he's a bodybuilder from Australia, and he just looks exceptional. And everybody like really gets inspired by him just simply because how he looks, you know, it brings up that type of energy. I know it's a bit shallow, but it's actually something you can think about that's very interesting in the modern context. Because maybe the barbarians back in the day might have looked a bit more strong, but nowadays we are closer to golems than we are barbarians. There's this problem where a lot of us need to learn how to idealize ourselves again, learn how to construct pressure upon ourselves, to systematize pressure upon ourselves. Like even something like choosing to go to the gym, as crude as this sounds in the context of talking about Christ and the church and death, like something like this is a great statement of power over your destiny. And like as much as people would like to say it, I genuinely think a very simple act like that is very much self-willed and in control of your life and something that you can regiment upon yourself. And it's a consequence of will. And there's sites with it that are very feminine. You must learn like form and technique and all these type of things, but ultimately it's you choosing to do something, you choosing to put yourself under pressure and recraft yourself and reshape yourself. And when you do that, nature responds by idealizing you, by making you beautiful, by making you powerful, making you strong. And what happens is your will to power grows. This is literally like a phenomenon that people notice when they start going to get at higher energy levels and stuff like this. And this way of looking at things, that's a very small nugget, but there's litany of other examples that I would love to talk about if you have the time, but you know, if we don't, we can go in all these different directions, and it forms a sort of, I would only describe it as a counter philosophy, maybe a balance to Christianity, but maybe also a complete counter philosophy, a whole new direction to go and say, look, we have to let go of this religion that we had that took us this far, that kind of gets us stuck in our heads a bit, kind of gets us obsessing about moralizing without understanding or without focusing on transforming, if you will, and a lot of different things in this regard. And the accusation then, of course, is Christianity holds us back from really embracing these things because of just the way that it is structured in this regard. And we can talk about that, Nietzsche's opinion on that as well. I think that's a very interesting perspective and something that I see actually having real results already, even in my own life and in people around me. It's a little bit of a gym bro philosophy, if you will.
Yeah. Go on. Let's think about the gym bro philosophy. Let's think about that. I think that for sure the idea of becoming a fat slob, you know, the idea that would be somehow related to Christianity is obviously, there's nothing to that, right? But you could say that the idea, let's say, of the gym bro, this is the issue, I would say, that one of the issues that Christianity is trying to deal with is that the way that the Romans and the Greeks, especially the kind of Athenian Greeks, the way that they had this worship of the body and this worship of the worship of the body and the idealization of the body, is that it tries to ignore it, and that's fine for a while. But let's think about it this way, that the Jim Bro philosophy, or the idea of the good looking fit person, is also what leads to other realities, which is the fact that we hide our old people, the fact that we don't want to see death, the fact that we think that old people should act like young people, the fact that the fact that we're marketed all these stupid products to make us look good and make us look young, right? It's like, I understand the self-willing part that you're talking about, but there are all these other correlates that are related to it, which is the 40, the 50-year-old guy who leaves his wife for the young girl and gets a Corvette or whatever stupid thing that the person will do to try to keep up that ideal that is going away. No matter what you want, it's going away. You're gonna die, dude, and you're gonna get old and you're gonna get decrepit. And so I think that, so let me give you another image, right? Which is the image of the monastic image. And we always have to understand it on a hierarchy, which is that the highest example you have is of someone who totally denies their body completely. They're like, everything I do is for the spirit. I do everything for the spirit. I will live a life of spirit in which I will even abuse my body, not completely, but to a certain extent. Like, monks will actually sometimes go far in terms of not taking care of themselves. They end up being really healthy for some reason anyways, and they end up living really long time. But what people don't understand is that downstream from that there's going to be a healthier version of the Jim Bro. There's going to be something like the knight, because the knight also has a kind of honoring of fitness and of prowess and of the capacity to be good in martial in a martial manner, to be able to accomplish certain feats, to accomplish certain adventures, and the beauty of the body will be part of that, but it'll be nested in something which also puts as the highest ideal the capacity to affront death. So what it will afford that knight is that maybe later in life, maybe when he's 55 and you know, things aren't going as well for him, he'll start to now have a practice of prayer, which will replace his practice of fighting and of doing all these other things. And then he can move into a more monastic existence as he gets older, so that when he dies, he doesn't die in the despair of his youth and the hair plugs and the bronzing and the tanning salons and all the crap and like the 60-year-old tattoos, you know, and all that nonsense that comes with the idealization that you're talking about as well, that at least I see in our culture.
Yes, and I actually agree. And I think it is a danger. Like, when I propose a Jim Bro philosophy, I would expect alarm bells to fucking go off like absolute madness. But at the same time, I would say that, like, I try very hard not to represent discount Christianity that you see nowadays as actual Christianity. I think there's also a case of this here, because we'll just call it paganism. The tanning saloons, the Guidos in Jersey Shore, like, that's sort of discount paganism. Like, that's
discount the paganism.
the lads hammering down like steroids and stuff like that. The lads on trend. Like, that's not necessarily. It's maybe got the spirit on some level, but it's like a really bad representation. It's like the church you go into that has a Starbucks in it. It's kind of like, yeah. All right, listen, guys. Like, wait a second, what are you doing here? Because I see you say, for example, the Greeks, the Romans, they lacked that confrontation with death, and maybe they did on some level, but I don't think it's entirely absent at all. In fact, they had a very strong warrior culture, of course, and they idealized in incredible ways. They achieved high culture and high virtues and values in incredible ways. for example, Dionysus, the whole energy that Nietzsche would talk about was understood as a youthful dying god. In fact, some people correlate him with Jesus, although we don't have to get into that because it's a bit of a rabbit hole. But it's that idea of the rebirth energy, and people can get blessed with Dionysus, like the way you get blessed with youth. This was a concept or a god or whatever, like the language fails us at this point, that the Greeks intuitively understood. And there was always this story that, you know, you had beauty, you had youth, Dionysus was with you, energy was with you, but it would be gone soon enough. Like you're not going to have it forever. And then there'll be another god archetype concept to replace its place. You would maybe get Demeter if you're a woman, or Zeus if you're a man, or something like this. And then Apollo.
Dude, Zeus is that guy, the 50-year-old guy in the bar, wearing a linen shirt, open up. That's Zeus, man. It's like Zeus, that's who Zeus he is. Greedo. I'm sorry to tell you. God, dude, he's not great.
Stream over, I lose. Like, he's actually right. Like, there's
but you get, look, like, I want to give you an image. Like, the image of the underworld for the ancients is an image of exactly what you said. That is the worship of a primal energy. One of the side effects of that will be that death is just a gloom. It's just gloom. Death is gloom and doom. And you better just eat the fruit while you can, because what's coming is dark, right? And so you can, if you compare that to the idea of resurrection, let's say, as an image, whether you believe in it literally or not, like if you compare it to the idea of resurrection, which is the notion that in death, like if you approach death with the right way, then you find new life. But that new life is not new life of being strong again. It's a different life. It's an inner life, which will kind of bring you this peace and serenity that you find in when you look at an old monk. Like I've met some old monks that are so completely alive. You know, you meet this 70-year-old man who has, like, you know, is just shining. It's like, what is happening with this person? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's because they have another vision of what the highest value is, let's say.
I think that's a very, like, deep and profound and wise thing to think about, the constant self-transformation that something like Christ says to you. You know, you can die and be born again. Like, that's absolutely true. And even the challenge of living your life is, you know, I've had to reinvent myself several times, and I'm only a young bloke, like, and it's like, oh man, I'm gonna have to do this forever.
How old are you, by the way, just the question?
28.
All right, 28. Yeah.
And absolutely, like, I've been through actually processes like that, where you're trying to pull yourself together, and you change and you're different, and you're absolutely, like, you notice that on some level you have to try put yourself together on a higher you have to look for higher virtues in order to put yourself together each new time. Like, you can't rely on energy as much as you could before, or just that youthful will, because it's not what it used to be in some sense.
Man, don't say it's not what it used to be at 28, because when you start, when you reach 45, you'll be like, oh man, what is going on here?
Oh my god, I'm black belt. Holy shit, wait a second, this Nietzsche guy, he got me in the wrong direction. Like, look what's happened to me already. There is something I do look at the past. I look at the Romans, the Greeks, all these type of things. Like, I it's maybe a bit naive, but I see many of these patterns present, you know. And again, this is sort of part of that argument, is like, could another direction be gone? Like, I don't, for example, with the idealizing of a higher virtue and truth. Like, I'm talking about Dionysus, the physical energy, the representation of instinct, the lower forms, the body. But Apollo, the god of music, beauty, harmony, truth, in some sense, the eternal youth, is representative of that idea of higherness and newness.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
In fact, he reminds me a little bit of Jesus in the way I understood Jesus when I was younger.
Wait, which one? Is it Dionysius or Apollo who reminds you of Jesus? Or maybe so it's both. Actually,
yeah, this is something that maybe I was going to bring up, or I'm going to get a symbol cocked here if I bring this up. I'm not too sure, but there was there's a Dionysian energy to Jesus at the beginning, where he's like the god who absorbs you in infinite love, and you, like, dissolve and become new again. But there's also an Apollonian perfection to him as well. That's like sort of in the head and idea.
Yeah, in the heavens. Yeah, so I think Christ is the meeting of Dionysus and Apollo completely. Yeah. You know, the way Nietzsche talked about him. Like, he does things like offer his blood and flesh to eat. He does all these extremely scandalous Dionysian gestures, but then he also heals people. And then he makes them right. Like he makes them whole. And he does all these gestures where he's making things whole. And it's like, and then he, then ultimately he ends up being the judge of reality and the one who stands above all things and names and judges the whole world. So yeah, he has a nice, he's a nice joining of those two.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Damn. I think Greek idealism just let me down there. Holy shit. I'm gone. But yes, I guess to bring it back to that, to the problem, if you will, is in some sense speaking to that. I think it's a very serious question. Like, regardless, maybe of even the paths, like we can discuss that more. I don't see people awakening with bursts of vital energy and organizing an explosive will to create new institutions and set a new trail forward and all this type of stuff. Like my fear, it's sort of a review of what I've already said, is that I see, even for example, you brought up the Christian nations that maybe are resisting so much now, is that it's reactive, it's resistance, it's on the back foot. It's like if you're in a fight, you're after getting punched 10 times and then you're like, whoa, wait a second, something's gone wrong here, that type of feeling to it. Whereas instead of saying like, how do we assert that step forward? And every time I find that conversation comes up, and it's specifically interesting to a young guy, you know, maybe I'll wise up and shut the fuck up when I'm older, but it's particularly interesting because it's like, you want to put your best foot forward and you constantly are confronted with things that are actually, I would literally call them demoralizing. Entropy is too strong. Yeah. There's no way that your will can be trusted. And I understand that. Like, I'm not trying to be unsophisticated. Like, there's definitely an aspect of humility that's necessary for a young man to learn. But there's also an aspect, like, take for example, a great fighter. Like, on some level, he has to sit down and trust himself over everybody, over his coach. He has to say, I'm out here to do this fight by myself. Like, no one's going to come in and save me. No one's going to humble me. No one's going to decide. I need to assert on my own terms, and those people can win and become champions. That's a real reality that happens to some people, not all people, which is interesting.
But it's you'd be surprised to find, like, listen, I'm not a fighter, but I think we all have things analogous to fighting in our lives, where there's an aspect where the will takes you a certain spot, and then there's a place where you're carried. And anybody who's had a really creative experience will realize that will goes only a way, and then you're carried and you can't explain it. And then what's acting in you is more than you. And what's acting through you, you can't explain, you can't describe. It's like, and then when you're done, when it's happened, you look back and you think, there was something else going on. Like, I found myself speaking sometimes, talking about something, and then for some reason, everything comes together. Then I say something. And while I'm saying it, it's almost like I'm not even in my body, and I'm looking at myself and I'm thinking, where is that coming from? Like, you never thought that before. How are you saying it? And then all of a sudden you kind of come back, right? And you're like, whoa, what just happened? Like, where did I go? Like, what is this energy that was kind of flowing through me? And I think that that's something that probably all the best sports people, all the best, that they have that experience too. And so it's like, even in the self-willing, there's a place where all of a sudden you're carried into something else. I don't know.
I definitely agree. I actually would say though, that I'm not sure if that's necessarily an incongruence from perhaps what I'm trying to say, nor what you're trying to say either. Like, that could be interpreted 1,000 different ways. Like, maybe that's the Holy Spirit or God himself saying, right, I'm going to reach into this guy and sort of take over because he's been making a mess of it the last couple of weeks or something like this.
Hostile to you, right? It doesn't feel like it's going against you. It feels like it's just bringing you up, right? It's like pulling you up.
I've had that loads of times. I've had these things where it's like, I'll be making a song, for example, and something will just, I'll just feel something and I'll be like, talk, and it will talk. And then the thing will come out, you know. I think the problem I would have is that I could categorize that. And I'm very careful not to ruin myself trying to categorize all this stuff correctly. I just let it happen. It's probably better I do that. But I would notice it would be like, you could call that an instinct, maybe. You could call that the subversion of the ego by something deeper and more primal and Dionysian. You could look at it that way. I'm not sure what it is. And I definitely agree, though, that like, you, especially when you're ruminating on things that are profound and bigger, and that's usually when that kind of triggers it inside of you. And it's an incredible point of health. But I guess what is our question? Are we trying to formulate some type of way of philosophy, cultural institution, set of tools, set of perspective, set of exercises, maybe all of those things that we can offer to people to say that, right, we'll give you more of these experiences, we'll make you get in touch with this type of stuff more. Because this is actually something that's very absent in the modern world. It's very much just like a consumerist hellhole that's in your head more than anything.
For now, like for most of us, it's not that. The first thing a lot of it needs to do is just stop gorging ourselves. Like if we just stop gorging ourselves, you're already going to come closer to this other thing, because we're so overfed. Like we're just you know, we're, and for of everything, right? It's like every desire can be reached. Like you can just put your hands out and get whatever it is that you want. And so, you know, and like you said, I agree with you that the idea even of physical disciplines in terms of martial arts or in terms of can help you kind of on the way towards focusing your energy, right? Because now our energies are just drooping out of us. They're just kind of oozing out of us. And that's what's making us so weak too. Like our attention, like not even just, don't even, you can think about it in terms of sex or food or whatever, but you just attention. Like our this world, this like computer world is taking our seed. It's like, it's stealing our seed from us, because it's taking up all our attention and scattering our attention into stupid viral bullshit. And like all these stories that don't matter, that can't make a difference to you in your life anyways. Like whether you know what President Biden did, I'm not American anyways. Like, why are we wondering about these things? Right. It's like, and so we our seed is being taken from us, but we're giving it away too. Like we're wasting our seed into these computers in so many ways that I think that just that, if people are able to kind of pull that together, then they'll find more energy than they think.
100%. And this is like, it actually kind of, it's like I'm trying to put on your shoes towards the end of it. It's inevitable though. Like Facebook figured out dopamine stuff. Like how can that get reversed without a Babylonian collapse? Do you know what I mean? Like it's going one direction. Unless we get the Chinese authoritarian state that actually takes the responsibility and says, right, everyone's banned from phones or something like that. And no one in the liberal West is going to want that to happen. And so what do you do? Like, where do you go about this? And this is actually a scary question. Like, is there, like, all right, what happens if there isn't an implosion? What if Babylon keeps on chugging on for 300 years like she did before?
Yeah, I don't think it's possible. There's an image in scripture in Revelation where it's Babylon, the whore of Babylon, and she's sitting on a beast, right? And the beast is actually a representation of all civilization. And so the way the beast is set up, it has different heads and everything, and it represents the different empires that have existed in the world. And so the whore is sitting on the beast, and then at some point the whore gets killed by the beast. The beast kills the whore, right? This always moves towards an authoritarian system, you know, this excess of chaos and of partying and of dilapidation and of wasted seed and energy it can only lead to authoritarianism. Sorry. Yeah,
no. Blackfield, here we go, lads. Have a good evening.
Blackfield.
And I guess, right, we'll say that inevitable is coming to happen. Again, when you're speaking to a young man like myself, like my fears, of course.
Yeah.
I don't want to sit down and twiddle my thumbs as Rome burns around me. Like, should I be like the Goths and saying to myself, like, what do I focus on to be part of something new? Like, what's the next step, you know? And again, it kind of comes back to me as that type of thing, is that the Christians, they will actually offer quite a genuine way to take a step forward, because they're like, look, we'll literally like have communities that will survive any type of infrastructure collapse. So you're going to be all right here. That's definitely a massive upside. But then there's also an aspect of like, all right, well, what could be created, what could be crafted, the masculine assertive energy that will build something new, that actually will set the best foot forward, as I said. And despite the fact that there's ruins all around and everything's kind of imploding, you're setting the stage for the next next thing, the next ion, maybe the next era, for all I know. And yeah, I guess like it's my fundamental problem. I'm not sure if I'm necessarily saying, John, like, you know, therapy here, figure it out.
Yeah, figure me out.
Should I just
dress myself? I need to go anyways. We've been going for like an hour and a half. I really enjoyed this. Like, I understand too. You're also younger than I am. Like, I'm 46 now. And so I feel what you're saying when I think of my son, like, who's 16, and I feel it even more when I think of him, because I'm like, okay, like, what is this world? Like, what is the world that he's going to? What is he? And there are little solutions. They're not easy, but like, I'll give you an example of my son, right? He's 16. A few years ago, I went to give a carving training in Saskatoon, in Saskatchewan. And when I got there, I met these Catholic families. They were all had 9, 10 kids, and they all homeschooled, and none of their kids had phones. And they were just the most amazing thing I've ever seen. All the kids, they all played music. They would put on Shakespeare every year. I saw like a 15-year-old come up to his friends and say, "Oh, I read this short story. I'd like to read it to you guys. Would you be interested?" And everybody sits down and he reads a short story to them. And so it was just like this completely crazy world. So I brought my son. I went there one time and I was like, this is amazing. So I brought my son there the next year and he loved it. And this summer he asked me, he said, "Dad, I want to go to Saskatoon. I want to spend the summer there." And he's 16 and he's like, this is what he wanted. He said, "If I stay here, I'm going to be on my computer. I'll be playing Minecraft. I'll be on my phone." He's like, "I want to go there." And so we sent him there to work there. He worked like construction. Yeah. And every, you know, twice a week, they would have parties with these different families and play soccer and, you know, have square dances. And it was like, this is a real thing that's happening. It's small scale. But this is like, you want to talk about vitality and just this energy that's flowing. It's like, it exists. It's just, it's expensive. Like, when you think about it, it's like, do I want to sacrifice my comfort for something like that? Like, do I want to sacrifice my phone, my internet, my whatever for something like that? It's expensive, but I think it's possible.
I think actually there's a huge thing there, because I talk about like creating new institutions. The way you're even describing that sounds like the old ancient education system in Greece, Rome, and in Christian Europe, which was the classical liberal arts education, like in the true meaning of the word, where you would develop the capacity of the person to the best ability you possibly could. And I remember I've been through periods in my life where I was obsessed about bettering myself, if you will, and so many of my virtues came from that, where I was too broke to even properly have a phone and stuff like this, so I had like a little Nokia thing and I had just the laptop, and I spent all my time like learning to sing and learning to write and learning to speak, and actually served me quite well in the long term. And it's a big challenge, like, especially as a young dude, you're sort of saying, because this is like the thing you're saying, the sacrifice question is pretty big. Do you step out maybe of the promises, the American dream of modern society, and find something that's more humble and put yourself together in that orientation? But look, I won't keep you any longer. Thank you very much for your time, sir. And yeah, I think this was absolutely excellent. It was great to actually talk about all this stuff, and it's fantastic to see. And I think we can both agree that Nietzsche, I was going to slag him off there, but maybe I beat him up too much. I think that's the bad. I guess what I'd say for your son is that just get him a bucket of blue paint, and, you know, just get him to get a couple of stripes and see what happens there. He might
that's
be
awesome.
All right. He might be all
right. All right. It was good to talk to you. I really enjoyed it. And I wish you the best as well.
See you later, sir. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.